We're talking about the Mekalel in Parshas Zemor. So in Parakhav David Dalit, Pasuk Yod, it says, Eitzah ben Isha Yisraelis who ben Isha Mitzri. So the woman, the son of a Jewish woman, who was the son of an Egyptian man, went out, B'soch ben Yisrael, among all ben Yisrael, v'yinatsu b'machna, and he fought in the camp, ben Yisraelis, b'isha Yisraeli. The Jewish man, right, the son of the Jewish woman, and a Jewish man. So, nothing here seems to be very, very, you know, very well explained. It says the word v'yetzeh, and then it says the word v'yinatsu, that he went out, and then afterward there was a fight. In Pasuk Yud Aleph, it says, v'yikov ben Isha Yisrael. So the son of the Jewish woman cursed HaKadosh Baruch Hu's name by Yikalel. And let me tell you, this was Shlomis Baz Divri of Matedon's. This is her child. This is what happened over here. Now, fact is, there are only two stories that are told over in all of Sefer Devarim. You have the death of Nadav and Avihu, which is a short story at the beginning, at the middle of Parsha Shmini and the beginning of Parsha Achremos. And then here, the Mekalel. It really comes out of nowhere. If I would ask you where the Mekalel was, it would take most people a few seconds to be able to say, it's somewhere weird. It's just in the middle of nowhere. It's not where you expect it to be. Now, Nadav and Avihu seem to make sense within the context of the Sefer. We're talking about the eighth day of the Miluim. They died at that moment. That's all there. But the Mekalel seems to be in a completely wrong place. For that reason, Rashi uses the drush called smuchen, the idea of one parsha put next to the other to explain what's going on here. So Mehechan Yatsa, where did he come from? Where did he come from? So Reb Levi said, Me'olamo Yatsa. Reb Levi tells us in the Medrash, and Rashi quotes it, he left this world. He came out from the bad world. Reb Raki says, from the parsha above, about the lechem upon him. He argued about the lechem upon him, and he said that the bread over here was being left out for 9 days. He couldn't understand why they were feeding the Kohanim 9-day-old, moldy, cold bread. Couldn't understand why that was happening. And the third answer is a brisa, and that's really where we're going to concentrate on a very confusing one. He said he left the Beis Din of Moshe chayiv. And that's what it meant. By Yetze ben Ishi Yisraelis, he left the Beis Din of Moshe after he was chayiv. He wanted to place his tent Machne Dan, claiming that he was Shlomis Bas Dibri's son, and Shlomis Bas Dibri was from Shevet Dan. But he was told that the camps were arranged by the father, not by the mother. So he had no right to sit in this camp. He took his case to Beis Din, he lost, and that's when he cursed out God. Cursed out HaKadosh Baruch Hu because he lost the fight itself. Now, before we start, Rav Schwab says that these three answers are very, very strange. But they must be. It has to be that they all work out together. So, for example, the lechem upon him, the problem with the lechem upon him, it makes no sense at all. We know that the lechem upon him was fresh. We know that it was given straight over to the people, and we know that it was felt warm even 9 days later. All that took was to ask one of the Kohanim what was going on, and they could see it themselves. They showed the lechem upon him was shown to the people, so that they could see how the relationship between them and HaKadosh Baruch Hu was so fresh and good. So that was without a question. How could he have thought otherwise? That doesn't make any sense at all. That's number one. Number two, the whole thing with Beis Din is very strange. Why would they have treated a ger so harshly? This man was the son of an Egyptian man who joined Klal Yisrael, and even if he wasn't a ger, even if you considered him half Jewish, why would you treat him so harshly and do such terrible things to him? Why wouldn't you have said, listen, lift me mishur again beyond the strict judgment, we'll let you stay somewhere? Would they have to kick him out? Did that have to be done? Why would they do such a thing if it didn't need to be done? That's the idea. So Rav Schwab says an amazing thing. He says that only those who truly believe that God works in this world are zocha to see the bread as warm and fresh. You wouldn't see it warm and fresh if you didn't see it with your own, if you didn't believe that HaKadosh Baruch Hu could do such a thing. People who believed that miracles like this could happen saw the miracle with their own eyes, and they saw what it ended up being. This man had already left his world, the statement up above of Reb Levi, Me'olamo Yatsa. He had already started to think that God really didn't run the world, that there was no Ashkacha process, that God wasn't taking care of all the little things over here. He started to make fun of the different things that were going on. And because of that, Shevet Dan wanted to get rid of him. Originally, he was accepted into Shevet Dan. Shevet Dan was the Ma'aseh, the gatherer who took in the people who didn't belong anywhere else. And they were willing to take this guy in, even though he didn't really belong to them. But in that sense, they said, we're willing to keep you as long as you believe in God. Once he started making fun of things and started saying about the lechem upon him that things were terrible, that he was yotza me'olamo, and then started making fun of the lechem upon him, at that moment he got kicked out of Sheva Dun and had to go to Beis Din to go in front. When he went to Beis Din and lost the case, Sheva Dun has the right to kick you out. Listen, Sheva Dun can keep you in, but you don't deserve to be left in. Once that happened, then at that moment he cursed God. That moment he went even further than where he was before, and cursed out God. Now Rabbi Yashiv says the exact same thing. He says something just like it. The man had no shaykhis to lechem upon him. He was from Sheva Dun. He wasn't a Kohen. He wasn't a Levi. But he used it as his excuse to go off and complain how God runs this world. So with the proper outlook, he says, you can see how the bread is warm and good. He did and he saw it differently. Rav Wolfson, in his Sefer Emunas Yitzchak, has a long piece about this. He goes on and says that the Mekalel's neshama, he says it based on Crazy's farm, is the same as the neshama of Yeshu, Yashka. And says that the same problem that Yashka had, that the relationship between the Jews and God is stale, it's the same exact issue that the Mekalel had, that it's stale, that the bread is moldy and stale. That's the idea of what he was complaining about. It's an amazing Emunas Yitzchak, but I've spoken about it before, so I'm not going to go on about it. Rav Shur also asks why Dunn wasn't willing to accept him even so and embarrass him the way that they did. How could they embarrass him this way? And he says the following. Rav Shur says, if a person comes to Dunn without a place and doesn't know where to go, Dunn gladly accepts him and takes him in. That's what Dunn says. Listen, we want you to join us because you have nowhere else to go. But if the guy says, I belong here, he says, I am part of Sheva Dunn, when he's not part of Sheva Dunn, that's where Sheva Dunn says, no, that's not going to happen. Then we're not taking you in. Sheva Dun is good up until a point. They're willing to take in anybody who understands that their place, or they don't have a place. But if the guy fools himself into thinking that this is his place, no, Sheva Dun says that's not what I want. So in all three of these things, the answers are seemingly identical. They're all going together. They're all being put together to come out with one answer. But either way, we're going to be concentrating on that third answer, the one that has to do with him going to Beis Din. So let's go into the whole story. The Miamalei tells us the story behind the story. When the Jews were slaves in Egypt, there were Egyptian taskmasters and Jewish slaves. That's what they were. Jewish, Egyptian taskmasters that were in charge of what the Jews had to do, and then slaves that were there. Among the Jewish slaves, there were some that were given extra privileges. They were the people that were called the shotrim, the officers that were in charge of other Jews, taking care of what the Jews needed. Now, they would be in charge. They would relay the messages of the taskmasters to the Jews that they were in charge of. And if the quota wasn't met, then the taskmasters would take it out on the shotrim. Aside from the individual Jews getting whipped while they were doing the actual work, the shotrim, the overseers that were Jewish, were also beaten up by the Egyptian taskmasters. In fact, in the end of Shmos, Rashi tells us that these Jewish shotrim ended up becoming the Sanhedrin. The 70 men that were used as the shotrim for Bnei Yisrael ended up becoming that Sanhedrin.
The
Mitzrayim? It seems like the Mitzrayim did, but it might have been they were the important people of the Jews themselves. I'm sorry,
they took the brunt of the beating. So.
He'd assume, yeah, and therefore they were rewarded by getting something like that. Either way, the shoter was the one who was there. Sometimes the taskmasters wanted the Jews in the middle of the night. So they would go to the Jewish houses, the shoterim houses, in the middle of the night, and they would tell them, get up, go get the people out there, and go get them moving. I want people to start a little bit early today. And the shoterim had no choice but to listen. They had no respite. If the Egyptian wanted something, they had to go ahead and do it without any question. So one such shoter was Dusan, at Dusan and Aviram Thame. Right? So one of those guys was Dusan. Dusan was married to Shlomis Bas Divri, who was a very beautiful woman. The Gemara says, Belim Mum, that she had no blemishes on her body, no blemishes on her skin. Everything was good by her. When the Egyptian man woke up Dusan, right, that's what happened. She came to the door and said shalom to him and pleaded with him, can you please, you don't have to wake him up now, it's too early, it's not the right thing. She said things to him that made the man think that she was trying to say something to her, trying to hint with innuendos that she was trying to be together with this Egyptian man. The Egyptian man waited outside, went back in, and then later on in the night, when the shoter was out waking up all the other Jews, he went in and was together with Shlomis Bas Divri. Shlomis Bas Bas Divri, when he finished, he left the house. As he was leaving, Dathan came back and saw the shoter leaving his house and goes into the house and said, was the Egyptian man here? And Shlomo Bas Divri said, I thought it was you. Now, what Shlomo Bas Divri really thought is up for debate. This is the only case that we have of an Egyptian man being together with a Jewish woman. The reason why is because we kind of think of the Egyptians as being these evil people that are just doing absolute terrible things to the Jews. But it happens to be that HaKadosh Baruch Hu always makes sure that when he puts us in Golos, the Golos that we're in is by a civilized nation. The nation of Egypt, although they had their faults and slavery was a major issue, they were a civilized nation. Think about it this way. The Jews had their own cattle and sheep. Why would they have their own cattle and sheep? When do you ever have slaves that own their own cattle and sheep? They had their own houses. They were not living on the farms of the Egyptians or doing what the Egyptians had. They had their own city and their own houses in Goshen. There were people who were sitting all over. There were still Jewish men who were in some way, they were known as the Shochrim, who still had some power when it came to Egypt. There were still some people that were like that. Duff and Avion were able to talk to the king. They had an audience with the king where most of it was afraid that he was going to be told on. He was the prince. And yet he was going to be told on for killing a random Egyptian. If you would be dealing with a monarchy, a real monarchy, if the Jewish prince, who's the son of the Egyptian king, gets up and kills one random Egyptian, that's not going to cause any problems for anyone. But there was something. The place was like that. They had rules. Among the rules were, you are not allowed to take a Jewish woman. You are not allowed to do anything to her. You're not allowed to take her as your own wife. No intermarriage was allowed. It was reverse racism, so to speak, in which they were saying to the Jews, you cannot be together with any Jewish woman there, even though they were the slaves. This Egyptian taskmaster, who then was together with Shlomo Bas Divri, was worried. If the shoter, Dathan, would tell on him to the government, not only would he lose his job, it's possible that he would be killed. The Egyptian taskmaster was so worried the next day when he saw Dathan, he immediately started beating him to death. Until eventually he'd be able to say, listen, he was not doing his job as a slave, and therefore it wasn't my fault. We were allowed to beat them. But he didn't want Dathan to do anything or to tell anybody whatsoever. That's the idea of what was going on over here and what was happening. At that moment, obviously not coincidentally, HaKadosh Baruch Hu made it through Hashgacha. Moshe Rabbeinu had me walking by, saw what ended up happening. And at that moment, Moshe Rabbeinu used his Ruach HaKodesh, saw what had happened the night before, realized that this man had been together, the Egyptian man had been together with his wife, and after a bit of a deliberation, Moshe Rabbeinu ended up killing the Egyptian with one of the shameless of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Used the shame of HaKadosh Baruch Hu in order to kill him and did that. The Midrash Seichel Tov gives a totally different version of the story. It says she was purely beratzon. She wanted to be with the Egyptian man. She answered with a smile, said shalom to him, and hinted, not just what the Egyptian man thought, but literally hinted to him, come in, I want you to be together with me. She was so accustomed to seeing the Egyptian taskmaster that eventually it was beratzon. And at that point, Shlomo Bas Divri was divorced from her husband, whether it was Dathan or somebody else. The Yalkut Shimoni says that Shlomo's husband was being beaten when Moshe Rabbeinu walked by, ran to him, saying that last night, it might be Dathan, it might be somebody else, last night the Egyptian man broke into my house, took my wife in front of my very eyes, grabbed her, made her do these things to her, right? And now he's trying to kill me so I won't tell anyone. He ran to Moshe Rabbeinu to beg for mercy. Moshe was so angry at what the Egyptian man did that he killed him on the spot. The Jewish man went home to divorce his wife, and the wife's brother, who was Aviram, fought the wife's husband, forcing him not to divorce his wife for what had happened. That was the story behind Dathan and Aviram. So a little bit different in that it was the ones, but it was a little bit different in that the man was there at the time when his wife was taken. And that's going to come into play a little bit later on. Keep that Yalkut Shimoni in mind. The fourth answer, the fourth medrash that's brought down is a Pirkei Rabbi Eliezer. Pirkei Rabbi Eliezer on Memchas in the Chizkuni says this was not Dathan's wife. It was a man by the name of Neria, the grandson of Dan. So we're talking Chashivas, and we're talking about somebody who was the grandson who probably saw his great-grandfather Yaakov Avinu. One night, the taskmasters came as a group to the house of Neria and Shlomo Bas Divri, killed him, took his wife, and impregnated her, and the Mekala was from that relationship. So either way, however this medrash goes, whether it was Dathan and it was somehow possibly Ba'ones, or Baratzon, or definitely Ba'ones, or with Nerya Ben Dun, somehow the Makawa came from that relationship. Those are the four Midrashim that comes through. Now, we don't know what happened. It could be that that Makawa always stayed in Egypt, considered himself an Egyptian person, and only after Kriyas Yamsuf, he joined Klal Yisrael at a later point. That's definitely possible. It could be that he stayed outside the clouds and was together with the Geirim that were outside the clouds with the Erev Rav, hung out with the Erev Rav, and only now decided to come into the camps to challenge to see if he could join Shevet Dan. A third possibility is that he was always in Shevet Dan, claiming that I'm probably Dustin's son. Who says I was from the Egyptian man? After all, how in the world do we know that the relationship happened? I mean, honestly, there was no DNA testing back then. So how do you know it was the Egyptian man's kid? Maybe it was Dustin's kid, right? And everybody thought it was the Egyptian man's kid. So he stayed in Shevet Dan. Exactly. So he stayed there until he had to, whatever it was. And the halacha is that way, by the way. If a woman is raped by a person, and in the end, you're trying to figure out who the child is, we hold Rov Be'ilos Hochenach Rabal. Most times that the woman is together, even if she's sleeping around and she's doing the wrong thing, Rov Be'ilos Hochenach Rabal, it goes up to the husband. We assume that the child is the husband's child, even if the child looks like the person that she supposedly slept with. It doesn't matter. We hold the halacha that that child is Rov Be'ilos. We would hold, if that child is the son of a lady, he would get the Levi Aliyah in Shul.
We trust the woman that rove at the time she's with her boss?
That's what we have. That's what we have halachically. In fact, I can tell you, there are unreal tshuvas from Moshe. I think, hold on one second, but there were tshuvas from Ramosha that he holds this so stark that even when the guy claims I was not with my wife for months, if the guy claims it, nonetheless, we hold rove Be'ilos Holchanachar about. And that we still say the child is a legitimate child unless there are Edom that show us the otherwise. It's amazing. Hold on a second. Yeah, Dave, what's...
This way, Shlomo Amal says there's four things that he doesn't understand. Like the bird flying in the air doesn't leave a sign. The ship in the sea doesn't leave a sign. The snake on the rock doesn't leave a sign. And
adulterous woman.
A loose woman basically doesn't leave a sign. If she wipes her mouth or something like that.
Oh, she wipes after eating, so to speak.
Her mouth and says, I haven't done it.
And haven't done anything. But it's clear that those are, this is halacha. Halachically, this is how we paskin. So if this guy was there, and this is going to come into play a lot, we're going to bring this up. Halachically, if the guy claims, right, that I'm not an Egyptian man's son, I'm the son. I mean, I know what the Torah says, but the Torah is lo b'shamayim hi. The Torah can't paskin what I am. Halachically, whose son am I? He could have claimed I'm Dustin's son, and you would have been right. Who was that? Yisrael, what were we going to say before?
Even say with DNA testing?
DNA testing obviously is 98% whatever it is percent positive and everything, but that wouldn't be enough for us because of this rove. You're dealing with a rove versus a rove. So it's a rove. It's not a badai. When you deal with rove versus rove, that's not good enough to defeat it.
DNA would not count.
Listen, it definitely would bring our shoshos up again. But I don't know. I'm not going to be that posted, but it might bring us, yes, to a couple shows. But regardless, it's not going to be the same thing. Something happened at this point. I don't know when this happened or whatever it was, but something happened at this point. Either this fight occurred a few Shabbosim in, at the same time that the Mekoshesh, the guy who collected the wood and grabbed the wood, at the same time that he was going around, the same time, this is what happened over here, that a guy heard a man making fun of the Lechem upon him and tried to kick him out of the Shevet by saying, it's stemming from your Egyptian father, because no Jew would ever say such a thing. It must be that you truly are the son of an Egyptian man. Either that's what happened, or the Panim Yafos, guys, it's amazing. It happened a year later. Remember, guys, who is he the son of? He claimed to be the son of Dasan, right? When did Dasan die? Dasan died, along with Aviram, by Korach. Korach and all of his men were burned up, while Dasan and Aviram were swallowed up by the ground. Who else was swallowed up by the ground? Dasan and Aviram's whole family and all of their possessions. So when everybody was swallowed up into the ground, and this guy survived, everybody sort of looked at him like, well, that's awkward. It's pretty awkward that you're still alive right now, which showed everyone that he wasn't Dustin's son, and that started the fight. That was the problem, which they said, you can't pitch your tent among Shevet Dan anymore. You're no longer Dustin's kid. You belong outside the camp. But again, we don't know when this happened. There's so much information that's missing. It's in Parshas Emor. It's in the middle of nowhere. Was it with the Mekoshesh? Well, that's weird enough itself. Was it a little bit later? That's also strange. Regardless, who is the man that fought with him? The Shach Alatora. This is one of the Bali, the Kabbalah guys. You know, one of the Talmidei Arizal, not the Shach and Shulchan Aruch, right? Not Rav Shach either. No, it's a different person. But the Shach al HaTorah says that this was Shlomis's, that the Shlomis's husband had another child. In other words, either with Shlomis, that she, Shlomis Bas Divri, had another kid that was definitely from her husband, let's call it Dasan, or Dasan married another woman and there was another child from that relationship. Says the Shach, those were the two people fighting. There was the Ben Ish Yisraelis, Ben Ish Mitzri, the son of the Egyptian man and the Jewish woman, and then the Ben Ish, or an Ish Yisraelis, Ish Yisrael, I'm sorry to say, he's Ish Yisraeli, a regular Jewish man, meaning the brother of that Egyptian guy's kid, that was the one who ended up fighting. When the man died, Dasan, it's possible, both sons came to inherit him. They both came to inherit him. The second son, claiming, I have no brother. You're the son of an Egyptian man. Everybody knew this story. This is the only time where something like this happened. So I think you're the son of an Egyptian man. You don't deserve to inherit any money together with me. That's what he said. While the first son, right, our good old Mikawa, our ignominious hero, right, he goes up and he says, listen, I have no proof. You have no proof. Prove to me that I'm not your brother. Right? So therefore, I should be able to go ahead and take it. Now, this is a real halachic dispute. You're dealing with money. You're dealing with money. So the question is, what do we do with money? So the first thing, there needs to be some givens before we go in. Like a math problem, there's a lot of stuff. The Chassam Sofer has 16 different Divrei Torah on this idea of what it meant that they were fighting with each other and what they were doing. He goes through Tosfos and Bav Metzia. He goes through Tosfos and Ksuvos. He brings up rushes. He brings down unbelievable amounts of abortion. And he gives, we're going to try to say some of the drachim, but not too many. But in five different ways with all these different boards that combine to be able to say what he ends up saying. We're not going to be able to do all of them, but here's something you got to know. Ein holchen b'mamon achar harov. We don't go by monetary matters after the rov. If there's a majority that goes one way, it doesn't matter when it comes to money. When it comes to money, you lose if it's just a rove. If you have no edim, no badang, no anything, just a rove, that's not good enough. Rove is not enough to take away money. However, a rove is good enough to keep money by you. If I have money in my pocket and I have a rove that shows that I'm correct and there are no edim around, then I can keep money in my pocket in most situations. That's what you can go ahead and do. So here's what happens. The first one is going to be like this. So number one, there was another child and that's when they were fighting, etc. The other guy claimed that, but this guy claimed, Robil Tolkien Acharav, I'm really the same, I'm under the same father, and we really are supposed to inherit together. Most Rabbeinu knew, but the guy claimed, Lo Bashamayimhi. You can't paskin that I'm the son of an Egyptian man, right? You can't paskin that way. It's not how we do la'alacha. La'alacha, even if Moshe Rabbeinu comes down and says, I know you're the son of an Egyptian man, you're not the son of Dasan, that's not how we paskin. Nobody can paskin that way. That's not how it goes la'alacha. So here's the pshat. The yatsa, the very first time, the very first word in the pasuk, Vayetze ben Isha Yisraelis, that he went out, and then Vayinatsu, and they fought. What does that mean? He went out from Beis Din, and then they fought. What does it mean exactly? It means they went to court, and they left court without a definite psak. Moshe Rabbeinu told them, I can't paskin. I don't know what to tell you. I can't go with one way or the other because you both have good claims and there's no way to do it la'alacha, right? I can only do it in Shemayim, so there's nothing I can do. So what's the halacha by that? What's the halacha when you can't paskin because there's nothing to do in this situation? What do you do? Think Baba Basra. Think Baba, no, we can't do that. We can't do that because by Mamon, you're not allowed to take away with Shemayim. You can't ask Nevi'im to paskin a case. This is a halachic monetary case. We don't do it that way. We never paskin. The only person who does is Mashiach, Morach Vadoyin. That's in the future, but they didn't do it. So what do? There's a halacha. Think Baba Basra. What happens by Ahu Arba? You have a boat that's sitting in the middle and nobody can make a chazak on it. Nobody's there. So what happens? Kol Dalam Gavar. Whoever's stronger wins. So by Yetze, he went out of court, right? And he didn't know what to do. So what do? They fought. They fought each other. Now, Kol Dalam Gavar, the machlok, is what exactly happens. It doesn't necessarily mean that they face off like Pacquiao and Mayweather. It doesn't have to be that way. It could be that each one brings the better proof over the other and they'd be able to fight each other. That could be the way it goes. But Kol Dalam Gavar can be a fight, and that's exactly what happened. After they left court and they didn't know what to do, they fought over what they were trying to do. And that's what ended up happening over here. That's the idea. I'm sorry?
It's
definitely not a Coliseum. It's definitely in the street. Yeah, it's definitely in the street. And you weren't allowed to shoot each other, so there probably weren't any guns.
So it's like what does a person win? Like, is it like, what is it, mercy? Is it like, how kind of free do you have to kill the guy?
There's no rules on this, unfortunately. Although that would be cool to have an entire Gemara just on how cold Ellen Gavar could win. It's like, after 10 rounds, they're going to be three judges that come around, and each one will count the amount of punches that they're able to do. All right. No, not like that. That, unfortunately, it's not going to be that way.
It's only according to one opinion of the Gemara.
Right, Kol Dom HaGavar, that's actually, by one opinion of the Rishonim, the Gemara doesn't speak about it, just as Kol Dom HaGavar, and then there's Machlokas Rishonim, what exactly the Psak is. There is another way of looking at it. If somebody is chayiv to make a shvua and can't make the shvua, right, if he can't do it, then he automatically has to pay. Right, we all know that, right? If the shvuah is upon you and you can't make the shvuah, then you got to pay. So the only time you have to make a shvuah by mominous case is if what? When do you have to swear? If there's one aid. If there's two aidim, you lose. If there's no aidim, the other guy loses, the claimant loses. If there's one aid, that's when you have to take a shvuah that the money is truly mine in my possession. Again, that goes with the chazakah. Okay, so this is the pshat. The Chassam Sofer says in his second pshat, he says the following. They were both mukhzuk in the sense of their father, which means it's a case of Shnayim Ochzin Betalus. You have the real case of Bum Mitzia Bezim and Aleph. They're both grabbing onto the tents and the pegs and everything else. They're both grabbing onto it. They both have a chazakah on the tent itself. And they came into court holding onto the tent of Dasan. Right? I know if he died with Korach, then everything would have been gone. Just to say it was somebody else then if it wasn't Dasan. But they both came into court holding on to the tent of their father. The real son claimed it was all his. You're the child of an Egyptian man. The Nitan, the guy who's being claimed against, said, prove that I'm an Egyptian, right? I don't know what to do. Here's the issue. There was already a coal that this guy was the son of an Egyptian man. Who started that coal? Where did that rumor start from? From Moshe Rabbeinu. Amazing. Because when Moshe Rabbeinu killed the Egyptian man, there were other Jews around. And the other Jews said, what did you do? And Moshe Rabbeinu told them, again, this is at the age of 20 while he's still living in Paro's palace, which is amazing. But he said, I saw that this Egyptian man impregnated this man's wife. Right? Or slept with this man's wife. I don't even say impregnated. But they all figured out when the child was born 9 months later, they're like, okay, well, it's probable. Right? That's there. So it was always a coal that was out there that this man was the son of an Egyptian man that was already there. Now, normally... Moshe Rabbeinu himself, he was not the judge. Notice it said, Mideiz Din Shel Moshe. It wasn't Moshe that judged the case, he couldn't. But Moshe was an aid to the Dover, but an aid to Ruach HaKodesh. Chassam Sofer says in parentheses, I don't know if an aid with Ruach HaKodesh really counts as an aid. But let's say for argument's sake that the aid does count as an aid. Since he's an aid with a coal that was going up against the guy, okay, so we have an aid and a coal going up against the guy, the Ben Ish Mitzri, they said, okay, here's what you got to do. In order to keep the money, you have to swear. Swear that you're not the son of an Egyptian man. Could he swear that?
No.
He couldn't swear that because he had no idea. How would he know if he's the son of an Egyptian man? So what happens if he can't swear?
Okay.
So you have to pay. That's when he lost the case. That's the idea. He came out from Moshe's Beis Din Mechuyev because Moshe was an aid. There was a coal against him. He had to swear, but he couldn't swear. So when you can't swear, you got to pay. So instead of doing that, when he heard that he had to pay, he immediately got up and he swore. But he used God's name and swore in a bad way. That's how he became the Mekawa. He said, I'm going to swear in a different way. That's what I ended up saying. He goes on. I'm telling you, there are unbelievable Chassam Sofers here. The Vayatza is that he left the tent and he lost his Chazaka. I'm sorry?
How could he possibly swear on something that he doesn't know?
That's the point. Mitol She'enu Yachol Yishav HaMishalim. It's not your fault, even if it's not your fault. Mitol She'enu Yachol Yishav, if you're not able to swear, Mishalim, you got to pay. That's the Halacha. Right? In all these cases. In this case, I know it wasn't his fault. But if you're Mechuy of a Shvu and you can't take it, you got to pay. So that's the idea behind it.
So you even substantiated enough that you have to
swear. In here, yeah, because of the coal plus the Eidos of Moshe Rabbeinu. That's the Kiddush. That's the Kiddush of the Chassam Sofer. Another answer, by Yefei, what did he leave? He left his Chazaka. He went out of the tent and was no longer holding on to the talis, so to speak. He was no longer holding on to the tent. When he left the tent, that's when the other guy said, it's mine now. and he grabbed onto it, made the chazaka, told the guy, you're not able to take it anymore, you don't even have anything, and therefore he went out. It's just crazy stuff. He goes on and he says it was in a different place of property and whatever it is. And then there's the clincher. The clincher is Rav Fishel Sofer in the back of the Chassam Sofer Al HaTorahs. Rav Fishel Sofer told over things that the Chassam Sofer said in Shir on Friday in Matzistor, what's the city of the Chassam Sofer? Pressburg, thank you. I think of Matzer's Dorf, because that's where all the Daf Sofer went later on. Regardless, right, Rav Fishel Sofer says, that's crazy, it's absolutely crazy. We know that an Eid Echad is not able to make such a thing. But what happened is when the Mitzri lost the case, he claimed that my mother is not the only person this happened to. There's no way that my mother was the only person who was taken from an Egyptian man. I'll bet there were other Egyptian men that were together with other women, and I'll bet you there were lots of people in Klal Yisrael that ended up becoming the sons of Egyptian men. So how do you know about anybody here? Maybe everybody here is a big fake in something like this. And in that case, then the Lechem Apanim doesn't deserve to be eaten by you guys. Because the Lechem Apanim, which was his original argument in the first place, the Lechem Apanim can only be eaten by people that are holy. It's supposed to be warm for that person to be able to eat. So you guys don't deserve to eat this. No one's special enough to be able to eat it. For this reason, for the Mekalil's claims, HaKadosh Baruch Hu added in Parshas Pinchas a yud and a hey at the end of everybody's names. HaChanochi, or the hey at the beginning, the yud at the end. HaChanochi, HaPalui, goes through all the different names of all the different Shvatim and all their children to show, no, this was the only situation in which this has happened. Although it seems so impossible to believe that there were slaves under another nation, and that it never happened, not among anybody else that didn't happen. Now let's go back to his gerus. The Torah's Quantum says that he was misgayer. Rashi quotes that and says that he was actually misgayer. The problem is that what would happen nowadays if you have a Jewish woman and a non-Jewish man that have a kid? The kid is Jewish. There's no need for a gerus, right? Halachically, there's no question whatsoever. This kid is absolutely Jewish, right? So the Chokmei Tzarfas, Rashi included, would say that was only true after Matan Torah. Before Matan Torah, which is when this Ish Mitzri was born, then it goes after the father, not after the mother. So therefore, the Ish Mitzri, how do they know that? That's the Kasha. But the Chokmei Tzarfas says that the whole din of how we go after the mother for Judaism is only after Matan Torah. Before, and it goes like the non-Jews, because we acted like non-Jews. And therefore, because of that, he had to convert. There was no way.
Why don't you switch it? I mean, so if that's the case, then the Shama, whatever you want to call it, came from the father, Petrolinium.
No, not in the Shama, just the person. Okay. It's not like spiritually, I don't think. It's simply put, it's that somehow, by non-Jews, it always goes by the dad.
Right.
It always goes by the father. By Jews, it goes by the mother.
Not Christians,
Christians
by the mother.
I'm not saying by that. I'm saying we, Paskin La'alaka, that by non-Jews, it goes by the father.
Right.
So if it goes by, because Brodach Bladim Ben Bladim, that's where we learn it from in the Navi. So if we go by the father, by non-Jews, we were non-Jews until Matan Torah. So before Matan Torah, it went after the father. Then at Matan Torah, we switched it. The halakha became that we go after the mother. So from then on, it went after the mother. From then on, we were Jewish, so it became something different. But until that point, it was like that. The Ramban argues. Ramban argues and says that from the time, and this is a crazy Ramban, it's a famous Ramban, from the time of the Bris Mila of Avram Avinu and on, every child that was born to Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov were all Jewish. I want you to consider that for a second. That means
Yishmael
and Esav are also Jewish. Well, Yishmael, not so much. Yishmael was born beforehand, so Epsher, you could say that Yishmael had his own bris, his own connection. That was something entirely. But Esav, therefore, was a Jew. He even brings a raya. Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky brings a raya to the Ramban. The Ramban seems to say it as well, that it seems in the Gemara Kiddushin Yud Ches, Esav is called Yisrael Mummer. A Yisrael Mummer, a Yisrael that went off. Now, everybody knows that Esav never ended up getting a Bris Mila. Yitzchak did not give it to him because when he was born, he looked very red. So his father always pushed off giving the Bris, pushed off giving the Bris, pushed off giving the Bris, because you don't give Bris Milas to kids who are very yellow, very red, very white. You don't give it to them. So he kept pushing it off until finally Esav was of age where he had to do it himself, and Esav said, no. He said, I'm not going to take it. So he never got the Bris Mila. But he's known as Yisrael Mummer. Says the Ramban, they all have status of Yisrael, right, up until, and it goes from Avram Avinu all the way down, which means it goes after the mother even then. Which means the Gerus over here is not a real Gerus. He was never Megayer. He didn't need to be Megayer. He was already Jewish because he went by the mother, and it was after Avram Avinu, so it goes by the mother by that point, and therefore it's like that. This is a huge Machlokas. Huge Machlokas. The Parshas Drachim has 35 5 pages on this machlokes, on whether they had the status of Bnei Yisrael or Bnei Noach at the time of the Shvatim. In fact, if you know, all the machlokes in between the Shvatim and Yosef HaTzadik were all about this. The Shvatim held that the status of Bnei Yisrael, while Yosef held that the status of Bnei Noach. It was the exact thing the Parsha is talking about. It was a whole big machlokes that goes through all the things that they argued about to understand what it was. That's the whole thing of Avraham Min Achai and all the things that were there. It was a huge, huge machlokes that goes through. Rav Hirsch says, it also says in the Torah Kohanim that it seems that he was a mamzer, right? Which indicates he was Jewish and followed his mother's status. But it could be that it's Kim mamzer. The Ramban says that he's like a mamzer, but he wasn't really a mamzer because he wasn't Jewish. He was a ger. The Ravid says it wasn't even referring to him. It's amazing. The Egyptian man who was together with Shlomis Bas Divri, that Egyptian man ended up converting. It was not the man that Moshe Rabbeinu killed, right, with the shame of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. It was another guy who ended up converting. So when it says that he converted, it's not referring to the kid. It's referring to the father who converted, and the kid at the status of almost like a mamzer. That's what ended up happening over here. Now, we're going to end up with one thing. I'm just going to run through this. I'm not going to say all of it over here. The question is, why is this brought up over here? That's the point of it all. Why do we need to know that there was a Makalo and Klal Yisrael? I mean, I'm sure there are things that happened throughout the Midbar that we know nothing about. If there's something here that we need to know about, what's the lesson? We need to know that somebody got up and cursed out God? We need to know that? So the simple answer is, we need to know what the halacha is if someone curses out God. Right? How cursing out God would be Machayev Yumisa. And that's what happened over here. How your Yake Yosi Es Yosi, the way the Gemara puts it, the way of cursing out God and the way the halacha goes, how it's going to be over here. It's fine. I'm sorry?
I mean, if I curse out God, why is it like the lightning bolt?
Dave, I know this is new to you, but that's not how this world works.
No, but I say action. I understand. I mean, you have, if you speak, usually it's Sarah, it comes from Shemayim.
I understand, but that's only with certain conditions, with Lashon Hara, etc., right? And there are certain situations where the Torah says, here's what I'll do in order to show you before you get worse. But that's not how this world works. That's the simple answer.
Lashon Hara is a spinner of a Havera. So even that thing, you're trying to say that, aren't you?
No, I think I'm saying, we classify things as things that are thought, then there's speech, and then there's action. Action we can handle in this world. Speech is something that's...
No. Hold on. There are many Averis that are speech in which you even get Malkus for. Right? We have that. There's no question about that. Right? And even, it depends on thought, but I mean, Lo Sachmod is still a Wav in the Torah, right? If there's an action that goes together with Lo Sachmod, you get Malkus, although it's really based on the thought as opposed to the action. So I'm not necessarily so, but either way, Rabbeinu Bachaya says something over here that we're going to end with that's really an amazing thing. This is to show that this is the only incident of anybody ever cursing God, out God like this. Where Victor Miller says, it wasn't like where we are today, where we have to believe and we have to think or whatever it was. God was so real to them that they felt it right in front of them. God was like their friend standing right next to them. It was so real to them that the people mamish felt like the same way you get angry at your friend, you got angry at God. It's like you're talking to your friend at the same time. It wasn't like this esoteric, how in the world, like, what's the point of cursing out God? People say, gosh darn it, with the real words, all the time. They don't think anything of it. They don't think of what they're saying or what they're doing. They don't think of it. Because God isn't real, as real as it should be to them. We're saying such a thing would be so bad. How could you say something? It's not like that. This was so much different. The lesson being taught over here is that even when God was so real to them, they had to understand, you are not allowed to curse out God in the way that they did over here. You are not allowed to treat Him with anything other than the utmost respect for the plan that is out there, even when bad things happen. Don't get angry at Him. Understand that there's more to it and that you just don't fully understand it yet. That's the idea that the Rabbeinu Bachaya gives, and I'm using Rav Victor Miller to be able to answer it a little bit more. But again, there's more to it than it seems. I'm still for the Miyamboli. They also give answers to this question, but we're going to end with this for right now. So just to go over the simple idea of what we went through, we started off and we tried to explain what the whole thing with the Lechem Aparim, how all three answers of Rashi all went together as one. We then told over the three different Midrashim, how this happened in the first place, with the Miyam Lo'ez bringing it down, the Seichel Tov, Yalkut Shimoni and the Pirkei de Rebbe Eliezer. We then went through when this possibly could have happened and who the person was that he fought against. We went through the Chasam Sofer halachically, what the halacha would be had they fought, what would it be in this case. We then explained what the Geirus could have been, the Machlokas we've shown him about what it could have been. Was he Megayer, was he not Megayer? And finally we end off with what it means to curse out Hashem's name. Why did we mention this in the first place over here? Why bring up this story and the ideas that the Rabbeinu B'chai wants to bring out from this? Okay, guys, we'll stop with this.